Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's so much talk about anti-aging drugs and regimens these days that it's easy to believe aging or its unpleasant effects is on the way out. A whole industry has grown up to serve and assert that view, and there is hope now in science for significant life extension. So what's real and what's wishful thinking? Will red wine and caloric restriction and a little dab of something push us way past 100? This hour on Point, we're looking at the latest on aging and age management. You can join the conversation. Are you taking steps to try to prolong life? Does that just mean healthy living to you? Or something more? Like what? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Chicago is S.J. Olshansky, expert on aging and longevity and professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He's co-author of The Quest for Immortality, Science at the Frontiers of Aging. J. Olshansky, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we could dive in so many places here, but my eye was caught. Here's a Business Week article just last week, and it says, testosterone is sure looking virile. And they're talking about testosterone sales being way up 25% in the 12 months ending in June to just over $1 billion now. And they say a lot of this is not, you know, teenagers looking to bulk up at the gym. This is boomers looking, just for example here, testosterone for a kind of fountain of youth. What's going on with that, Jay?
Well, that's worrisome, actually. And testosterone isn't the only hormone that's being sold as an alleged anti-aging intervention. There's growth hormone as well, and some other hormones that are touted as having some sort of rejuvenation properties. You have to realize this has been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. Hormone therapy replacement was a popular replacement therapy at the beginning of the 20th century. In fact, interestingly enough, some of the earliest interventions were, we refer to them as the gland grafters. These were physicians who grafted the glands of goats and monkeys onto older men, thinking that the hormones contained within them would rejuvenate these older individuals. I'm sure most of them died from an infection of one sort or another. But this modern introduction of hormones as an anti-aging intervention is sort of the most recent version of a very old theme. It is premature to be using any of these hormones as anti-aging interventions of any kind. We don't know what the detrimental effects are, and more importantly, we don't know whether or not there are positive effects, as is claimed by those selling them.
We'll look at where some positive effects might lie and what we're seeing here, but it's not only testosterone. I mean, it's been around, but up 25% is quite a boom, and I assume that's riding the wave, in no small part, of boomers who are aging.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's going on here is this huge baby boom generation born between 1946 and 1964 is moving into the 65 an older age range, and we're not doing it easily. We're not doing it well. And so we're fighting along the way, and we've got a lot of money, this particular subgroup of the population, and there are plenty of practitioners of what, you know, some refer to as anti-aging medicine or age management medicine, claiming that they can slow, stop, or reverse aging, and they'll work very hard to separate people from their money. Now, having said that, there's a lot of good work that's going on by some who are encouraging people to adopt healthier lifestyles and eat less, and those are reasonable and proper, and those will, in fact, improve the quality of life. But it's these hormones and supplements and other products with outrageous and unsupported claims that is worrisome, and your example of testosterone is one of them. It has yet to be studied in sufficient detail in clinical trials in humans to be used for that purpose.
What about human growth hormone? I know that's been around for a while, too, but now there's talk, and it's within this context of what's being called age management. Age management, that also, it's not the only thing by any means. There's diet, there's exercise, there's a lot, but that one also seems to come up.
Well, growth hormone is an interesting example. We know that the introduction of growth hormone to some older adults actually can have some beneficial effect for some. It can increase muscle mass, reduce rate of bone loss, improve skin elasticity, even mental acuity for some. But I can tell you that all of those same benefits you can get for free with exercise. You don't have to pay whatever it is, $1,000 a month for the growth hormone. The problem is that there are some serious side effects associated with the use of growth hormone, and there's experimental evidence from animals, models indicating that introducing growth hormone to older animals may shorten their lives. Now, it's true, humans do produce less growth hormone when they grow older, and it may very well be a biological adaptation. It may very well be the right thing for the body to be doing because cells are progressing towards cancer as we grow older. And the last thing you want to do is introduce a growth agent into a body that's producing more cells that are moving towards the cancerous stage. So it's a very, very dangerous area that these individuals are moving into who are either selling the hormone or using it. And I would add, by the way, that the use of growth hormone as an anti-aging intervention is illegal in the United States.
Off-label, strictly off-label, or really illegal?
There's the irony. It was believed for a long time, at least up until 2005 or so, that even the off-label use of growth hormone for anti-aging was, in fact, allowable. And it is not. A colleague of mine, Tom Pearls, and I from Boston University, published an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association a few years ago documenting the fact that it is illegal, even under off-label use, to administer growth hormone as an anti-aging intervention. And it's still being done today. After our article was published, the people who were promoting it didn't say, they stopped calling it an anti-aging intervention. They said it was used for growth hormone deficiency. But there really isn't sufficient evidence to be using it for most older individuals.
It's so interesting. At the same time, science is moving ahead on this, and we'll talk about that. There looks like there's a kind of battle royal here, you know, within the kind of medical public health community. I mean, there you are at the University of Illinois, Chicago, you know, School of Public Health. And I'm reading here, this is CNN a couple of years ago, you were hit with a $120 million defamation lawsuit by the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine after you had, as CNN puts it, accused the organization of promoting quackery. Now, you countersued, everything got dropped, but that's, big guns being pulled out here.
Well, you have to realize in the world of academics, especially in my world in public health, our job is to protect public health and to convey as best as we can correct information to the public. So it was my responsibility, and it remains my responsibility, to state what we know and what we don't know. And so in this particular example, we were stating what we knew to be true, and the people who were selling whatever it is that they were selling didn't like it, and they'll do whatever they can to silence us. And fortunately, my university, University of Illinois, was extraordinary in their defense of academic freedom and, for professors to do what they're supposed to be doing, which is to convey information, especially public health information, to the public.
But how do you see it? The whole idea of age management, this phrase that's being applied to a kind of school of medicine, people setting up shop, and what this is very often not covered by your health insurance, but if you pony up $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a year, they'll kind of do a whole lot of things to keep you at least feeling younger is the claim. What do you think of that whole approach to aging and treating it?
Well, it's a combination of good and bad. On the one hand, what you see among some of these age management practitioners is correct. It's based on science, and that is they encourage people to adopt healthier lifestyles. They encourage them to exercise more and eat right and eat less. Don't smoke, don't drink. I mean, these are things that we've known for a long time, and there's nothing new there. And I'm sure people who go to some of these clinics and begin to adopt these lifestyles do, in fact, feel better because of it. The problem is when you introduce a whole series of tests and nutritional supplements and hormones with the additional claim that this will stop or reverse your biological aging process, as if aging is some sort of disease that can be stopped or reversed, therein lies the problem, because it's there that we don't have the scientific evidence to back up those particular claims.
Of course, you yourself wrote in The New Scientist in 06, not that long ago, you said the experience of aging is about to change.
Yes. Well, now there is the excitement. The irony is that you have this whole anti-aging industry trying to sell us something that doesn't yet exist. And yet, in the world of science, there have been absolutely remarkable and exciting advances that have occurred just within the last 10 years that lead my colleagues and I and many others to believe that we are on the verge of a breakthrough that has the potential to actually slow aging in people. I'm not anticipating dramatic life extension, but I am talking about something that has the potential to actually dramatically extend the health and the quality of the lives that we have. And I think that is it's an extraordinarily exciting time to be involved in research on aging, to be sure.
Within the lifetime of the boomers who are so eagerly reaching out here, it looks like, for the testosterone bottle?
Yeah, the ones that are reaching out for the testosterone bottle should put their wallets back in their pocket, protect their money until a genuine intervention comes out that is designed to actually slow aging. And I think that time is relatively soon. I'm very excited about this research.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new push for age management and the science of what's really going on the anti-aging front. S.J. Olshansky is with me from Chicago, Illinois, on the air, of professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois, Chicago. We're going to hear from more voices in this hour. You may have been hearing on the air some ads for a kind of new way of looking at aging. One ad that is out there is from Cenogenics. It's a Las Vegas-based company, promises to help manage aging through a variety of techniques, including hormones. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jeff Life. I've been a doctor for 35 years. You may have seen my pictures in national publications and wondered if they're real. Well, I'm here to tell you they are real. Cenogenics changed my life. I'm 70, but I feel like I'm 30, and I'm not the only one. The Cenogenics program of healthy nutrition, exercise, and hormone balancing is also helping thousands of others.
Cenogenics has given me more energy than I've had since I was a teenager.
I went from 260 pounds to 190 pounds, and I feel great.
My libido was like I was 18 again.
Try that out. You may, Jeff Life there with Cenogenics, and Dr. Jeff Life, and you may have seen the pictures. It's a bald guy, sort of above the neck. He looks, I don't know what age, 70-something maybe, below, hyper buff body in blue jeans and all the rest. The ad reads, says GQ magazine suggests protocols used in the Cenogenics medical program may actually reverse or slow down the signs of aging. Other benefits include increased energy, improved muscle tone, decreased body fat, increased sex drive, libido, and improved outlook on life. Looks like quite the deal, and never mind aging. Let's get a call from Sarasota, Florida. Jay, you're on the air, Jay.
Yeah, I've listened, and a question, and certainly goes to the issue of the use of testosterone with respect to the prostate in elder males, and there is a real push to that use will affect improved prostate. Whereas urologists and doctors and other people in the practical business of dealing with people who have those problems questions that, in fact, discourages that because of the negative side of growing the prostate because of testosterone. And so are we seeing, and there's some people within the medical profession who encourage this, as I said, but in a different sort of way, that you're really restoring people. So it's a real serious question, and that is at the heart of what makes getting older more difficult for males.
Yeah, absolutely. Jay, let us pick it up. Jay Olshansky in Chicago, is what about the interplay between testosterone and prostate? Is there a connection here, a benefit, a danger?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know the linkages between the use of testosterone and its effects on the prostate. But you have to realize that in the world of science, we like to base our conclusions on scientific evidence or empirical evidence. And what you often see happening here, especially in this world of anti-aging medicine or age management medicine, is individuals essentially conducting a biological experiment on their own bodies. If you don't have the evidence that it works, why are you using this? Why are you putting this into your body? And these are individuals who may be watching every single morsel of food that goes in. They put in pure water, hormone-free meats, whatever it is that they're doing, they're being very careful. And yet they seem to be perfectly willing to experiment by putting hormones and specific supplements into their bodies.
Well, maybe they do it because it makes them feel better. I read a piece by George Plimpton a few years back where he had done, rubbed on some testosterone, and he was saying, I don't know if this is placebo effect or what, but I feel great. I feel young.
Well, there are, there are plenty of examples of people who've used substances that have temporarily made them feel better. I think ephedra might be the classic example of a product that was used that seemed to have some beneficial effect. It seemed to help people burn calories. And fenfen is another example. And, once they were finally studied using clinical trials, it was discovered that it actually caused heart valve dysfunction in about a third of the people that were using it. Mm. So, you have to be careful what you're putting into your body, thinking that you may feel better for the moment, but end up dying shortly thereafter. You have to be careful about this. You mentioned Cenogenics, by the way. The person who created Cenogenics died a few years ago at the tender age. I think he was in his late 60s, and he was a heavy user of growth hormone. So, you have to be real careful what's going on out there.
This
today
is the company with the super buff Dr. Life front and center. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Leah. Leah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I take resveratrol on a regular basis, and I'm a big believer in kind of science-based and evidence-based things. I usually don't take any kind of supplements or anything unless there's some real science behind it. But I have been reading a lot about resveratrol. There was a piece in the Science Times several months ago, and it made enough of a influence on me to actually take it. And I just wanted to ask if the doctor knows anything about that particular supplement.
Are you feeling 19 again, Leah?
Honestly, it hasn't really made a difference. I was a healthy person before I started taking it. The one thing that I did notice is that there was a period of about six months to 8 months that I stopped exercising for various reasons, and I had my blood tested, and none of my numbers really changed. And I don't know if that was because of the resveratrol or just because that's the way my body is, whether I exercise or not.
Let us look at it, Leah. Thanks for your call, Jay Olshansky. What about resveratrol? Is this related to the whole red wine world?
Yes, resveratrol is a compound contained within the skin of red grapes, and there is some very solid research indicating some potential benefits associated with the use of resveratrol. There are still clinical trials ongoing, and I think we have to wait till those clinical trials are finished before we begin using it for any reason whatsoever. But this is one of those examples of a compound that, and there may be related compounds to resveratrol, that may have some beneficial effect. It's important to realize, by the way, that you'd have to drink about 1,000 bottles of wine a day to get enough resveratrol to have any impact at all, if indeed it does have an impact.
What about when it's reduced or concentrated in a pill, 1,000 pills or one?
No. this line of reasoning that you can concentrate everything into a pill, it's the same thing with vitamins and nutritional supplements. We seem to think that there's some vital substance, and if we just concentrate it into something and we
magic
eat that,
when
it'll have the same effect. And unfortunately, the evidence isn't there yet. I would wait until the studies come in to determine whether or not it is safe and whether or not it's efficacious and whether or not it does what they say it does.
One of the areas which has received a lot of attention and shows promise, though it's not easy, is calorie restriction. And I want to go to St. Louis, Missouri for a moment, if I may, to Luigi Fontana, Associate Professor of Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. He's Director of the Division of Nutrition and Aging at the Italian National Institute of Health, where they know something about eating, though I'm not sure about caloric restriction. Luigi Fontana, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello.
Talk to us about caloric restriction and aging. If we eat little enough, will we age more slowly?
Well, the evidence in animals, it's really robust. I mean, there are hundreds of studies in mice and rats showing that these animals, they are living longer and healthier. And now this summer on Science, the Weindruch's group published a paper showing that also in monkeys practicing calorie restriction they have a 50% reduction in mortality for cardiovascular disease, a 50% reduction in mortality for cancer, no type 2 diabetes, no obesity, and there was also some evidence of a slowing of brain aging, so there was less atrophy in the brain, in some brain regions.
Mm-hmm. And what about for humans? Is it doable? Is it a manageable level of caloric restriction required to make a difference? Do we know if it does in humans?
Well, let's say that, you know, we are living in a society where there is an epidemic of obesity. So in our society, I think calorie restriction with good nutrition, because calorie restriction means that you have to reduce calories but eat all the nutrients required. So don't get me wrong, if you are eating, if you are doing calorie restriction with malnutrition, you are damaging yourself.
Right.
But, you know, if you are eating all the nutrients and you are reducing your empty calories, then I think, you know, there is no doubt that people will benefit. You know, if you are overweight or obese, there is no doubt. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming.
But we've read about some of these caloric restriction programs that are so severe that it's almost superhuman to maintain that low level of calorie intake.
So let me go into this, the next phase. I mean, for the average American that is overweight, he has abdominal obesity, I mean, there is no doubt that it's beneficial. Then the question is, if you're already lean, a normal lean person,
okay,
you know, are you doing better if you go on calorie restriction? We don't know yet. The evidence that we have so far is that people that are following calorie restriction with good nutrition, they have, you know, cholesterol of 160, they have very low blood pressure, 100 over 60 of blood pressure, no inflammation, very low glycemia. So all their cardiovascular risk factors are very low. And they have a younger heart, more elastic blood vessels, and they have some of the same metabolic hormonal adaptation that we have seen in mice and rats. Mm-hmm. But to conclude that, you know, calorie restriction will work in humans, in lean humans, in prolonging life like we have seen in animals, we cannot say that.
Though all those descriptors sound pretty good, let's get to New London, Connecticut, and Carl. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you know?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a kind of a comment statement. I had been using calorie restriction well over 30 years ago, and the benefits that the previous gentleman was talking about are exactly the benefits that I've enjoyed pretty much throughout my life.
What's your height and weight, Carl?
I'm about 5'10", and I weigh about 168 pounds.
And have you worked hard at holding your weight down, and what's the evidence that it's working?
I do exercise regularly. I walk or run, usually walk, about 15 miles a day. I do a little aerobic dance. I do some very light weight training.
Are you 85 and a spring chicken? Do you think
I'm actually 60.
Okay. Do people look at you and say, "My gosh, you look 32"?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's.
Yeah, I have easily passed for my 30s.
That's the kind of thing everybody's looking for. J. Olshansky, is this calorie restriction, plus you hear the exercise and so on, is that the magic path or just good health?
Well, Luigi is absolutely right. There is definitive evidence that reducing our intake of calories can improve our health and length of life. And he's right. You know, of course, we are in a world in which there's an obesity epidemic. So everybody would be better off if they could reduce their intake of calories, lose body fat, and exercise. And in fact, all of the benefits that, you know, you heard from the guy from Cenogenics, you know, with the use of all these hormones and whatnot, you get with diet and exercise. Now, whether that...
Well, that's part of their plan, right? I mean...
Yeah, which is fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether the caloric restriction is reducing the risk of disease or whether it's slowing aging, I think is irrelevant to the general population. What matters to the general population is that they feel better and they live healthier longer, and reducing caloric intake will do that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we're doing the exact opposite. We're increasing our caloric intake. We're getting fatter. And, you know, this is the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
I mean, behavioral modification You know, not smoking, not drinking excessively, reducing our intake of calories. That's the low-hanging health fruit that is right there before us, and we should be taking advantage of it.
Let's go to Julie in Middleborough, Massachusetts. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
The question I had in terms of living longer is that many of our body parts do not seem designed to last more than about 80 years. You know, our eyes are exposed to UV light and we get cataracts and our lenses make us farsighted and we get hearing loss and our joints get arthritic from overuse. And I'm just wondering if the human body really is designed to last more than about 80 years and whether we should just try to be healthy.
That's a great question. Design kind of obsolescence or natural endpoint to it. Luigi Fontana, what about it? Eyes, joints, ears, they wear out, Julie says. So what's the point of trying to push
Well, there are 2 points here. First of all, calorie restriction in animals has been shown to slow down these aging process. So, I mean, you know, the joints, the hearing and everything is postponed. So, I mean, you know, the people, they are having this physiological deterioration of these parameters much later than in animals eating ad libitum. And then my interest is not really living longer. I'm not interested, you know, to have people living 200 years, but I'm interested to have people to understand how we can have people living in their 80s, 90s without developing chronic diseases, without suffering and without, you know, this huge cost for, you know, the healthcare cost will increase tremendously because of this epidemic of obesity. And the data in animals and in humans now are suggesting that most of the chronic diseases that, you know, we are many people in U.S. and in the world are experiencing, they are preventable.
You know, caloric restriction is difficult for a lot of people. Is there on the horizon, Luigi Fontana, some kind of pill that would give us the benefits of caloric restriction without the lovely agony of actually doing it?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that it's not true that, you know, I mean, everybody thinks about caloric restriction like, you know, these small portions of food, you know, a plate, you know, that is half empty.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. I mean, the people who are doing calorie restriction, they're eating huge quantity of food, but they have basically eliminated the junk food, the food that is refined and processed and rich in empty calories, and they have increased the amount of fruits and vegetables, some whole grains, some beans.
Okay,
some
so it's so, fun.
I mean,
but
it's not restricting. So the idea of, you know, eating very small portion is wrong. Second is that about the pill, well, I don't believe in the pill. I mean, the mechanisms through which calorie restriction are working, they are multiple. So there are multiple mechanisms that are playing a role. And so I cannot foresee, you know, I may be wrong. I mean, science maybe will tell me, no, you're wrong. But I cannot foresee, you know, you can take one, two, or three chemicals and, you know, you will be younger and healthier and you can keep, you know, eating junk food, be sedentary, smoking and whatever. I don't believe in that. What I believe is that if you are healthy, so if you are a normal, healthy, doing some mild calorie restriction, you're doing some exercise, then some phytochemicals, some compounds can potentiate the effect of this healthy lifestyle without being extreme, without being extremely calorie restricted or doing extreme exercise. That's what I believe. But I don't believe in the magic bullet, you know, will prevent aging and prevent diseases and then people that continue to be on an unhealthy lifestyle. I don't believe that.
Luigi Fontana, thank you for the insight there on the calorie front. We're going to come back and look at the genetic side of this aging equation. Luigi Fontana is Associate Professor of Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. Luigi Fontana, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new push for age management and the science of what's really going on the anti-aging front. Jay Olshansky has joined us from the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He's co-author of The Quest for Immortality, Science at the Frontiers of Aging. We're going to hear in just a moment about the genetics of aging. Let's get a call or two. Mark in Buffalo, New York. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very interesting. Professor Olshansky had indicated that aging was not a disease 15 years ago. Tufts University, funded by the U.S. government, defined that disease, and they called it sarcopenia. And sarcopenia basically is the wasting of lean tissue replaced by fat. And the irony, I think, in all of this, which is at the cellular level, if we can, and of course, Canadian universities have done tremendous studies in this area as far as how the body adapts specifically to resistance training at the cellular level. And it's absolutely phenomenal what can be done. They did a study, I think, with 65 individuals over the age of 65.
Resistance training is weightlifting, more or less, Mark?
Heavy resistance training with the things you've indicated, Tom, all the diet, you know, eliminating all those things that basically destroy the body's energy system, which is the mitochondria. If we get to the mitochondrial level, such as what's going on in the West Coast with the Methuselah mouse and so on and so forth, I think what you do is, what we do here at the Age Reversal Center here in the Buffalo area, is we use the polar system. Polar that basically gives you your biological age. Polar is the folks from Finland that created the heart rate monitor and so on, and took the Tufts University 10 biomarkers of aging, put it into a marvelous program, and basically gives you your biological age based upon, you know, your fat percentage, your VO2 max, how much oxygen your body can use.
So you're at an age reversal center. That's what it's called in Buffalo. And do you have people, you know, paying you out of pocket to sort of turn back the hands of time?
Absolutely. And doing wonderfully well with very little else outside of very good nutrition and something which basically raises the glutathione level inside the cell, the so-called GSH level inside the cell, which is basically what fires the body up, the energy system of the body that keeps the lights on, and they keep you young. And they found, the studies have clearly shown that a series of exercises over a six-month period actually reverses the transcriptomes inside the mitochondrial DNA.
Okay, Mark, stand by. We're into transcriptomes and a little beyond me, but I want to get the reaction here, if I may, of Jay Olshansky in Chicago. Okay, Jay, here's, you know, the Age Reversal Center, and you hear Mark's line of thinking on this, and no doubt he's got, you know, people coming in to do it. He says he's finding good results. This is kind of the age management business. How do you respond, Jay?
Well, first of all, the specific mention of the use of resistance exercises or weightlifting, I think, is one of the classic examples of an intervention that we know definitively improves health and quality of life among people used at any age. Whether these individuals are, you know, 20 or 80 or 100, these types of exercises are dramatic and the benefits are immediate. My own father, who's currently 94, went on a resistance training program in his mid-80s and began feeling better immediately. Did he reverse his aging? No. Did he reverse some of the signs of aging? In other words, was he able to increase his muscle mass? Yes. It's not the same as reversing your biological aging. And I would differ with the caller who suggests that you could somehow measure your biological age with a battery of tests. This has been tried for a long time. It is not currently possible to measure our biological age. There is no evidence that this is possible. There are lots of people who are selling tests with this particular claim. The scientific evidence is not there. The National Institute on Aging spent a considerable amount of money trying to find biomarkers of aging. They failed. That doesn't mean that they're going to fail in the future. There may be some biomarkers that do, you know, reliably measure biological age, but there are none out there today.
Mark, what's it cost to come to your reversal center and have? Mark's gone. Sorry, it sounds like Mark has moved on. But Mark, I appreciate your calling in, and you hear Jay Olshansky's response. So let's get a call from Los Angeles and Saad, you're on the air.
Yes, hi Tom. I'd like to add another dimension to the scientific evidence here that aging is also genetically programmed. You know that there is a certain disease entity called progeria, where there are some children that age very fast. They are 10 years old and they look like 100 years old. And there's also evidence that there are some families that have people who don't age. You know, they can live on to, they age and they live on to the hundreds, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence here is there any, the research is showing, is there any genetics that can be turned on or off that can control the aging process, i.e. the senescence or the death of normal healthy cells?
It's a great question, and we will pick it up. It's true. Years ago, I interviewed a fellow who was at that time said to be the oldest man in the world, lived in the islands in a very southern Japan, on a very tiny island. I asked him the secret to his, he was about 120 then. He said he just did everything late. He said he just got married late, didn't leave the island until he was 50, just did everything late, including apparently dying. But let's look at the genetic part of this. We're joined right now from New York City by Nir Barzilai, professor of medicine and molecular genetics, director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. Nir Barzilai, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a good day in the Bronx, as you know, with yes. The longevity of the Yankees.
World Series champs, the Bronx Bombers. How about our genes and longevity? I've been reading here you saying that you've been looking at centenarians, and you found a lot of them 100 years plus, and they've been doing everything wrong. Not vegetarians, not real active, a bunch of them obese, and there they were 100 plus. Is that genes at work?
Yeah, let's be careful with the lesson and what our listeners are going to get out of it. When we go to 100 years old and we ask them, why do you, you know, one of many questions, an open question, why do you live to be old? They answer us two answers. One is, what do you mean? My mother was 102 and my grandfather was 108.
I'm not so old.
There's strong family history. Mm-hmm. And then we say, okay, come on, now though, tell us the real secret. You know, you eat yogurt all your life. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing that 500 cases later of healthy people over the age of 95, between 95 and 112, average age 100, I don't have anything interesting to tell you. We don't have a vegetarian. We don't have anybody who exercised or was an athlete. 30% of them were overweight or obese in the 1950s when nobody was overweight. Mm. And 30% of them were smoking two packs a day for more than 40 years. I have a woman who's been smoking 95 years now. She celebrated 95 years of two packs of cigarette smoking.
Oh, no.
So the lesson here is, you know, A, yes, if you smoke for 95 years, you live long life. There's no doubt about it. But really, the point is that if you take the 100 years old, which is my study group, they have not been doing what every one of us should do. Okay, they haven't been doing, they were not interacting with the environment, and that's why they were a great group to actually look for longevity genes.
Yeah, and so do you attribute this just to the genes? It's just baked in the cake for them that they were bound to, likely anyway, to live a long time, genetically determined?
Well, we found several genes, three of which were validated, actually four of which were validated by other studies as well. So it's markers on the genes that have a functional consequence. They're associated with several outcomes, and they seem to be protecting 100 years old from variety of age-related diseases, and two of them are even subjects for drug development.
You mean you could somehow change our genetic longevity inclination with a pill?
Well, yes, in the sense, you know, it's not a genetic treatment, but once you find the pathway, you can design a drug to do what those genes, difference in the genes are doing in the individual subjects. So the answer is yes, it's just drug development. The genetic method will just help you point to where you need to intervene.
Is that decades away? Is it closer than that? Will it work on someone who's already 40 or 50 or 70?
So first of all, Merck has a drug in phase 3 that is actually used, or their indication is to change the level of good cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol, that is extremely high in centenarians and their children. We have their children too. And however, we found that the people who have this this certain genotype are protected from cardiovascular disease, and even more important, they're protected from cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease. Oh. So we think that this drug is going to extend not just to its role in lipid, in cholesterol metabolism, but it's going to actually protect from several age-related diseases.
People will be lined up around the block for that. Jay Olshansky, do you see genetic studies as a path to significant lengthening of human lifespan?
Well, let me just say that this is some of the most fascinating and important research in the world of aging today. And what's amazing about this work, the study of centenarians and supercentenarians, is that the evidence is already here. These are people who already live past 100 or 110, and they don't have cancer or heart disease, or at least they haven't died from cancer or heart disease yet. So the empirical evidence, the scientific evidence, is here that this works. And there's clearly these individuals won the genetic lottery at birth. And so what Dr. Barzilai and others are doing is trying to discover what those specific genes are that's contributing to that protection and confer that protection to the rest of the population. My prediction is this type of work is eventually going to lead to a Nobel Prize.
A Nobel Prize and much longer lives for many more people, or is that pie in the sky?
I don't necessarily believe it's going to lead to significantly longer lives. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows definitively how much longer these types of interventions are going to make us live, but they are in all likelihood going to make us live significantly healthier longer. And as Dr. Fontana suggested, and I'm sure as Dr. Barzilai would suggest, that's really the goal of this work, is to make us healthier longer.
I want to agree with that. I think the drugs that will develop have to focus on prevention of chronic debilitating age-related diseases, and their side effect would be longer life.
Yes, agreed.
For the individual, that's going to be lovely. For society, what's the net? What's the bottom line here, near Barzilai? Does it cost less because they're not chronically ill, or cost more because they're around and consuming for another, I don't know?
That's a great question. So I'll tell you the answer from our studies, but there are other studies that support it. You know, somebody who dies now in the United States at the average age of 78 has been sick in the last 5 years of his life. I don't know, maybe Jay has a different number. But our centenarians are sick in the last 8 months of their life. So not only did they have an extended healthy lifespan, when they get sick, it's a much shorter period. And so in medical cost only, because there are other issues, there could be a saving. And in fact, the CDC have shown that the last years of 100 years old cost third the price of the last years of people who dies when they are 70 years old. And remember, the 100 years old, when they were 70, they didn't even go to the doctor. So
right.
The cost was zero.
So as, because it's not long and chronic, it's sort of short and comes at the end. Jay Olshansky, well, first I guess I should ask you, Nir, how close is this? Is this a drug treatment based out of genetic science that maybe near enough that it's relevant to our whole debate about the cost of health care? Could it change our national profile in those terms? Or are we talking way down the road, never mind?
Just because there's a first drug that can be tested for that, I think it's very relevant to have an interdisciplinary discussion of where we're going and what's the cost and what the other consideration that we have to have. You know, my 100 years old, some of them are working and have a very, good and productive life. Some are painters and things like that. So there's a whole discussion that needs to come, but I think we could, in our time, we can achieve our maximal lifespan, which is maybe 100 as a species, maybe 100, maybe 120 years, but to get there healthy, I think it's something that we have to aspire to and we should achieve.
All right. Jay, we've just got a couple of minutes here. So out of all of this, give us your sort of nutshell advice to people listening, whether they're 20 or 50 or 80. You know, right now, what do you advise and what can we look forward to on the aging front, Jay?
Well, what we can do now is clearly diet and exercise. That's the low-hanging fruit. We need to lose weight. We need to be exercising vigorously and frequently. And we need to be cognizant of this wonderful science that is ongoing now that I think is going to lead to the extension of healthy life. And to answer your earlier question, the extension of healthy life would be a huge economic boon to the individuals and to the societies in which this happens. My colleagues and I have referred to this as the longevity dividend, suggesting that this should be, this effort to slow aging should be the new method of health promotion and disease prevention in the 21st century. And I look forward to seeing it happen.
If 78 is our average lifespan now, or something like that, what do you see in 20 years, in 50 years? Will it be 108, 128?
No, I don't see it going to 100 or 128 anytime soon. But if we could extend life by 5 to 7 years through interventions that slow aging, but more importantly, extend the period of healthy life by that amount, it would be dramatic. The doubling time for most of the things that go wrong with us is about 7 years. So if you slow aging by 7 years, you reduce the risk of everything that is negative about aging by half. It would be dramatic.
Near, how about your, what's your estimate? If you look 20 years out, are we still going to be 80, 85 as an average lifespan or something greater?
I agree with everything and every number that Jay said. I just want to emphasize that we as doctors and the National Institute of Health as organization is very organ specific. You know, we treat organs, we treat diseases, and most of the diseases we treat are age-related diseases.
And we see the significance of that, and we appreciate it. We're out of time for today. Nir Barzilai at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and Jay Olshansky, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.